consider a black. Simple. So the change of area is change of the Schwarzschild area, which is 16 pi m squared, and which is this. And then the idea is to identify the change of its mass modulo h bar to the quasi-normal frequency. That's the basic idea. I do not go into the immediacy parameter thing at this moment with a purpose, which being that in what follows for the quantum gravity, the immediacy parameter this line, strictly speaking, is irrelevant. It's a separate offshoot, and we'll come back to it in details later. But at this point, we can just pick this immediacy parameter thing and compute or state what the entropy of a black hole is for loop quantum gravity. It's n, the number of punctures of spin networks in the on the black hole edge horizon, times log of this factor, where Jn is the spin corresponding to the representation of the spin network states that one is taking, S2 to 3 or whatever. So this is the answer. You can write this as the number of punctures in the first black hole area divided by change of area, the minimum area quantum, which is this. Now, delta A, by this identification, I write as 32 pi m times, this is the omega here, sorry, omega quasi-normal modes times this factor, which I can write as the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy times this. Okay. Now, the entropy of the black hole, which is S, would become, or the entropy computed from loop quantum gravity, would equate to the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of the black hole if this factor is 1. So the question is whether the top could be equal to the bottom. The answer, at least tentatively, is yes. If you assume the numerical value or later analytically computed value of the quasi-normal modes for Schwarzschild black hole in any dimension, in particular this here, the 4 dimension, that has been computed, we add log 3 by 8 by n. So if you put this here, this factor becomes log 3, and the top becomes log 3 as well, if you choose the minimum spin representation of 1. Therefore, it does agree with the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. So I have not, again, mentioned anything about the immediacy parameter. That's another output. Yes.
So, in general, quasi-normal modes have both real and imaginary parts. So what do you mean by omega?
I mean the real part. So thanks for pointing.
So it's the real part.
Yes.
Now all the quasi-normal modes, are they equidistant? Is this factor of quasi-normal modes is characterized by a single number?
Yes.
The single only asymptotically has.
Well, here the single number is of course mass, as you can see.
No, but it doesn't mean that the discrete spectrum of quasi-normal modes,
right,
should have, should be equidistant, is it?
Well, for the real part of the quasi-normal mode of the Schwarzschild is this.
Okay.
And here it has only one parameter, m. Now the interesting thing is, as we know, 1/8 πm is Hawking temperature, right? So in the examples that we will consider, in all the cases we see that it turns out to be proportional to Hawking temperature. So that we can call, now of course Hawking temperature has 2, 3, whatever number of parameters in a general case. But they arrange in such a way that it becomes Hawking temperature, except for the degenerate case of course, where the Hawking temperature is 0, then it turns out to be proportional to the horizon length. So we'll come to the detail. Now, okay, so let me mention something about the quasi-normal mode and black hole area spectrum. In general, apart from or independent of loop quantum gravity, now we saw that the identification of the change of area, minimum quantum of area, with so the quasi-normal mode real part using the Bohr's correspondence principle or something like that, that's independent of loop quantum gravity, and this is the answer that one assumed. And this means that the area spectrum of the black hole appears to be equally spaced. Okay, because this is the minimum area spectrum, so if you change it by 1 unit, this is this, if you change it by 10 units, this would be the full area spectrum. Which means that the entropy of the black hole, if you assume the Boltzmann definition, would be exponential this area by 4, which turns out to be 3 raised to 10 in this case, which is an integer. Now this is, I think it's quite a very interesting result, because you expect the number of states to be an integer, and this identification is clearly consistent with that, although this 3 may not have been 3, it would have been 5, whatever. But it is definitely an integer in the polynomial form because of that form and leading the identification. Question is, what about other backholds? And that's the short right. What do you expect for other backholds if the physical interpretation is goes? That is the question which I would like to ask. Firstly, as I said, log 3 can go to log a, any integer, doesn't matter. So 3 is not that important, unless you're interested in loop quantum gravity, which are not at the moment. So log k is what could come out. Second is that the black hole area spectrum, by a similar argument, would again be proportional to an integer n, and proportionally constant due to log k. N is the pure number, an integer. And this is again quite consistent with quite a remarkable conjecture that Wittgenstein made about a decade back, maybe more, that the horizon area for a black hole is an adiabatic invariant. Now, the way Wittgenstein proposed it was by using some quite a few Gedanken experiments. Like, you have a rising knot from black hole, you can throw a charged massive particle in it, and explicitly you can show that if you do it slowly, by a very slow process, the horizon area becomes invariant. So that was one of the few thought experiments which formed the basis of this conjecture. But the horizon area of the black hole in all cases is an adiabatic invariant. Now, if that is the case, now adiabatic invariance is again consistent with an equidistant spectrum from the Bohr-Sommerfeld Wilson quantization rule that any adiabatic invariance can be quantized. However, there is more to it, that an adiabatic invariant is always associated with a periodic system, and it's basically the so-called action variable for a periodic system. It's PDQ integral over a full particle, which means that if this conjecture is true, if Wittgenstein's conjecture of horizon area being adiabatic invariant is true, then we would require the Wittgenstein-Hawking entropy or the black hole entropy to be an integral of this form dE by omega, where dE is the energy of the black hole, omega with some characteristic frequency. We don't know what. Now, black hole could have many characteristic frequencies. This could be one. This is a basic requirement from if you want to take adiabatic invariant seriously. Now, again, we have one frequency at hand here, which is the quasi-normal mode. And for Schwarzschild, writing the quasi-normal modes as T Hawking times log 3, where 1 by 8 by n is T Hawking. So in general, for a black hole, suppose the quasi-normal mode was T Hawking times log k, then we can insert this value of omega as the quasi-normal frequency here. As you can see, that it turns out to be, let's ignore the constant of course, normal log k, but it turns out to be proportional to dE by th. Now dE by th is ds from the first law. Therefore, indeed, Wittgenstein's conjecture turns out to be true if the quasi-normal mode frequency is identified with a characteristic periodic frequency of a black hole being regarded as some hypothetical periodic system. Okay, so it all seems to fit in. These are consistency checks, if you like. There is a more elaborate way for spherically symmetric black holes with charge, as well as for black holes with rotation. I would not go into the details, I'll just show one transparency. It can be shown that for spherically symmetric black holes, and later it was extended for non-spherically symmetric black holes as well, in a bunch of papers, that you can actually prove quite rigorously that the black hole horizon area is indeed an adiabatic invariant, and the black hole horizon area or the entropy proportional grid is proportional to the integer plus the ground state energy. Now, this is also consistent, but I'm not interested in this for this talk, so I will not go into the details. So now, what we try to look at is to find the most general quasi-normal mode for all black holes. Now that's a hard problem, but it's quite hard. So we do as best as we can. So we, at this point, we generalize it to all spherically symmetric single horizon black holes with arbitrary horizon and singularity structure in the origin. And we do hope to generalize it to other cases as well. Now the metric for the black holes, spherically symmetric black holes, can be written in this way. The second line is the same metric in tortoise coordinates. The tortoise coordinates is defined. So there are, in strictly speaking, you need two functions, f and g. But we kept rho squared arbitrary here because some black holes are best expressed in those form. Does not mean that they're independent. But you can certainly write a spherical symmetric metric in this or the second equation, which is the tortoise form. Near horizon, we assume a very simple horizon structure. At this point, we assume it's non-linear, therefore, the near horizon f and g functions can always be written in that form. So it's the first order expansion. Hawking temperature from here can be reduced, you can calculate the surface gravity. Hawking temperature turns out to be this. And the tortoise coordinate, at least the leading term, or the lock term, which would be important for quasi-normal modes, there is always a term of the tortoise coordinate near the horizon, which looks like this. There could be one divided by r minus rh terms, where r is the horizon area. But they would become unimportant in your calculations as if you omitted it. So this is the relevant part of the tortoise coordinate near the horizon. For example, for d-dimensional spot type, these are f's and this is Hawking temperature. For d-dimensional, well, capital D is actually the number of space-time dimensions minus 2. So it's the dimension of the sphere, the angular dimension. So this, I really mean this is a capital D plus one dimensional for example. So this is the Hawking temperature of f and d. This is for extremal horizon non-strong. You can, there are all kinds of black holes. You can write in convolutional form. Near the singularity, this is what we choose. The singularity structure, or the metric near the singularity looks like this, where dy, y is essentially the time scaled out by the constant of the order of 1. R is the radial coordinate as usual, this is the d sphere, unity sphere. And p and q are simple rational numbers. And you can, it's easy to, it's almost trivial to show, I guess.
So why is that important to know the structure near the singularity? I suppose you can pick quasi-normal modes, you just need to impose appropriate boundary conditions. And appropriate boundary conditions at the horizon is only incoming flux, no outgoing flux.
Well, the way quasi-normal modes have been recently calculated into the monotomy approach will also need the structure near the singularity. That's the first thing.
So you're saying that something will be missing? Then what will be missing in the approach when I just, you know, have a boundary condition that empirically says that the perturbation dies off, and then no outgoing wave from the horizon? What will be missing if I compute? That's a standard way to compute, by the way, if I would wear to string theory, you know. At least that's what people were doing there.
Yes. I don't know what will be missing, but there are certain black holes which fall into this structure. I'm not sure whether you can compute the quasi-normal modes in that.
I'm very suspicious if I need to know anything about singularity in order to describe quasi-normal.
You're suspicious of the mathematics, or you're suspicious about the
physics, whatever you call it. I think the singularity structure is irrelevant for this question.
Okay. At least the way I computed it is not irrelevant, but we can talk about the details, right? But yeah, the way we compute it, we do need to know the potential, etc., at the singularity. It does encompass all of the black holes.
But that's not, how can that make sense? Because in a black hole, when we have a horizon separates black hole geometry into two causally disconnected regions. So how come my perturbation, which I can express in terms of, you know, quasi-normal modes,
right,
how it can be sensitive to what is happening in these two quasi-normal?
Well, I mean, I agree, of course, that the horizon separates into two quasi-normal regions, but that does not necessarily mean that the singularity is irrelevant.
No, that simply means that if I'm outside the horizon, and if I study perturbations around the black hole geometry,
right,
should be, that information should not be sensitive to anything inside the horizon. Because nothing can get out. That's what causal and disconnected means. There cannot be, there cannot be causal contact between that. That's why I find very suspicious that, you know, we have to worry in doing those computations.
Okay, let's see how it works out. Okay, so anyway, this metric was proposed quite a while back, around a decade back, and it, as I said, it does encompass almost all exact solutions, including black holes, cosmological solutions, and a host of others. And it's easy to see that P and Q are small numbers. For instance, for a capital P plus two dimensional structure, this would be P, Q, and X, this would be the Torres coordinate. Beta is some number order one, so I've not written explicitly, you can ignore it and just assume you want for all practical purposes. For non extremal Reichstein Nordstrom, these would be P, Q, and Torres coordinates, and for other host purposes as well. In general, you can connect the FNG, this form of the metric written, with this singularity structure of the metric that I've written here. So near the origin, F and G would be connected to P and Q as powers of R this way, and this would be the Torres coordinate in general. So with this assumptions, we'll start computing the quasi-normal modes. So, as I said, we'll consider scalar perturbations just for simplicity. You can include vector tensor perturbations that would essentially bring out one more term near the regular potential. That's all. Okay. Now, yeah.
So those scalars are actual components of symmetric?
Yeah.
So how do you know that that's a minimal coupled scalar? Because there are black holes, there are just charged black holes, which if I study thermodynamics, those black holes that have chemical potential.
Sure.
But
this is
situation is not a minimal
coupled
scalar. Why are those scalars? They're not components of metric phi.
Well, if you consider metric perturbations, you can part of which are scalars.
You don't consider a scalar on the back, on this is that.
Maybe, but I'm just saying that there are between not all perturbations of minimal coupled scalars. There are black holes which are charged black holes in which it's not a minimal coupled scalar. That's the black hole where when you study thermodynamics, you introduce a chemical potential.
Yeah, but why can't you just study a scalar minimally coupled to gravity? That's what I don't understand that to mean.
But that's not related to the quasi-normal modes, because by definition, the quasi-normal modes is the response of if you throw something into a black hole, how it will respond.
Yeah, that something would be a scalar.
Yeah, so.
Well, no, not necessarily, because the scalar field itself would have quasi-normal modes.
Okay,
but
so
you usually find the answer is the same when you look at that part of the metric perturbation, which is what I think the force.
Yeah, so this would be part of metric perturbation. This could be just minimally stuff. I mean, there could be complicated calculations, sure. That could be so this calculation being just minimally complicated. You can easily extend it to other tensor fields, but not minimally coupled.
Well, I guess I am. I just want to clarify for myself.
Sure.
So in this formula, in the quantum gravity, when we relate the change in the area to the quasi-normal mode,
right.
The quasi-normal mode of what enters there? Because I know that those the quasi-normal modes will be different depending on I agree that you can just say I will study minimal coupled scalar and I will study the response to the perturbation.
Right.
But that quasi-normal mode will be different to the quasi-normal mode if I do metric.
For certain
class of
holes. True.
So that's why my question is, in that expression, when people write this in quantum gravity, what was the normal mode is then? What formula you have? What's that frequency?
This calculation is motivated from loop quantum gravity, and that's about it. I'm not really using loop quantum gravity.
So you basically just study quasi-normal modes of minimal coupled scalars without relation, whether that's related to
I'm studying the quasi-normal modes of minimally coupled scalar field, which is also metric perturbations for a large class of black holes, but it is not, as you say, for many black holes. And that's what I mean. And for those black holes which it is not, you can think of them as scalar perturbations of the black hole, minimally coupled scalar perturbations. And if you want to study metric perturbations, which are scalar in those levels, of course, you add non-linear coupled. Now, this is the Regan-Wheeler potential for the arbitrary metric in the first dimensions. Near the horizon, you can simplify things and write them in this form. And it does have two terms here. Now, here is one place where the singularity structure at the origin actually comes in. The reason is that if you compute the singularity, like whether it's a regular singularity or a regular singularity, now infinity is an irregular singularity. At horizon, it is always a regular singularity. You can just take this metric and do all the analysis and find out. Horizon is a regular singularity. At the origin, if you demand it to be a regular singularity, which I think you should, because otherwise you wouldn't get a good, nice solution of the differential equation. If you assume that it is a regular singularity of the origin, at the lack of singularity, then you get two conditions on the powers that I have here. So essentially, I have power p here, power q here. And we get two relations between p and q, which are q greater than 0 and p minus q plus 2 greater than 0.
Just have our own boundary conditions. The correct boundary conditions is just the flux. There is no outgoing flux at the horizon. You are right. The horizon is a coordinate singularity.
Right.
But there is still a boundary condition.
I would use that boundary condition anyways.
And you get the same answer?
Yeah.
Then why is the information of the system?
Well, I was going to say that if you assume this, assuming that it is a regular singularity of the origin, then the second term in the Regan-Wheeler potential simply drops. And we get a somewhat simpler Regan-Wheeler potential, which goes like this. Now that's what I have used. So we can solve the equation with this. So this is an additional information into life, but I think it's a perfectly legitimate thing to assume that it is a regular singularity of the origin. And I don't see, it is not inconsistent with the ordinary boundary conditions of the ways that one assumes that the horizon is infinite, which is here. But with this simplification, the second term in the Regan-Wheeler potential drops out, and we get a very simple term actually. So let's forget this constant generally order one. So we get essentially 1 divided by r power 4 over t. That's what we get. And then finding the solution of it is quite simple. The solution is of this form, so it's the Bessel functions here. Now, the Bessel function, the constants are chosen in such a form such that at infinity, the Bessel function behaves this way. Now, this is basically with this new metric and the differential equation with this Regan-Wheeler potential, we are essentially repeating very closely the calculations of Mottl and Lischke. So, I think that's quite new here, except a few minor points. Now, with this boundary condition and the outgoing boundary conditions both at infinity and the horizon for further non-local modes, we get two conditions. One is this combination of a plus and a minus must be 0 satisfies the boundary condition. And secondly, the wave function, the solution itself has to behave in this way in the infinity. So we get two such conditions. Then we again repeat the usual monotony approach that Mottl and Lischke had proposed. So we go from the negative imaginary z-axis to the positive imaginary z-axis. And when we make that transformation, we simply complexify R and X, which is the daughter's coordinate, and Z is simply the complexified version of the daughter's coordinate. Now, if we make this rotation, the R coordinate, it can be shown that it rotates by a factor 3 by q over 2, where q is the singularity structure. So r power q x power q was the coefficient of the d-sphere. And with this r, z rotates simply by 3i pi, which is actually the same, an identical amount of rotation that Mottl and Lischke have formed. And that's interesting in the sense that the q does not, although their q was different, they did it for short time and higher. right? The Q sort of drops out when you consider the rotation per se. It's just 3 pi pi exactly what they have found. So the rest of the computation goes through. Using properties of Bessel functions, you can calculate the Monod week in this approach, which turns out to be this, where alpha plus and alpha minus are just constants. This form is depending on the P and Q. And you can simplify these identities that this is the Monod week that you find at the end of the day, which from which you see that the one can see that the P drops out, and Q, let me remind you, is this function here, x to the q, the coefficient of the sphere. That's what remains here. You can, one can compute the monotony near the horizon, and near the horizon, the monotony turns out to be 4 pi omega c naught, where c naught is the coefficient of the law in the tortoise ball. So this is c naught. Now, c naught for non-degenerate black holes is essentially the Hawking temperature, but for degenerate black holes, it is proportional to inverse the horizon radius. So finally, what we get is this, and equating these two, since they must be the same, we get the quasi-normal mode, the real part that I'm interested in, as 1 divided by 4 pi c naught log of 1 plus 2 cosine pi over 2 t q minus 2, where t plus 2 is the dimension of the black hole, and q is the singularity x power q at the instrument. So this is the final result, and this is the real part of the quasi-normal modes. Now you see that the log. Okay, let me write the result once again here, and I just write the real part. That's what should be of interest. So the real part is written in this way, can be written in this way. Now, one sees that the log seems to be generic, because you know, to find the quasi-normal mode, you have to take a log. So that's how this log appears. But in general, I don't see why this quantity here has to be an integer like 1 or 2, not 1, 2 or 3 or 4 or whatever. In fact, if you analyze this, this quantity would be an integer only in two cases. Well, there are infinite series, but there are others which where they're not. So there will be two cases where they're integers. One is when this coefficient here, or this argument here, pq minus 2 divided by 2 times pi is 2 j pi, where j is an integer, or pq minus 2 divided by 2 times pi is n times 1 third pi, where n is an integer as well. So there could be infinite number of cases where it wouldn't be integers. But the interesting thing, I mean, that what we see here, that we computed or we applied this formula for many, many cases, like quite a few I'll show here, but a few others as well. And for whatever black holes that we did compute the quasi-normal mode real part frequency, it did turn out. I don't have a deeper understanding. Yes.
Could you just remind us, so in the original computation of Markov and Minkowski, so did they also have contribution from the simulation?
Yeah, they do basically what I'm doing. So, yeah, I mean, as I said, I mean, beyond the.
But you said, I saw that you were saying that when they were doing the computations, they really impose the boundary condition at the horizon.
That's when you find that you find monotony in two ways. One is you go, like, you take the context variable, say the argument. So you take the contour from here, you go to the horizon, which is, say, argument 1, if you normalize it, and you go around, go, and then you close the contour. That's one way. The other way is you go straight up, you make a small circle near the origin, okay? And then you go straight up again, and then you come back. And then you equate it. That's the basic technique.
So is there a computation that would lead me to an answer to the quasi-normal modes of the Schwarzschild or where I don't need to know about the similarity?
But there are numerical computations, as you know, of course, and I think they didn't use the singularity structure for those.
Maybe my question is that Q that you use to parameterize the singularity, is that something that I can see, you know, in the horizon geometry?
At this point, I don't think so. Again, to answer your question, I mean, The numerical computations, I forget who, old computations, there I think what you say is what they did, that they just didn't near the rise and then infinity. There's an earlier paper by Subhash Motul alone, where he uses a much more complicated method, and I'm not very well versed with it. And there I don't remember exactly at this point whether he used the rise and infinity.
Well, the reason I'm saying is because I don't, that's been a while since I looked at this issue, but I know that it's a case of ETC platform. There was a computation of the quasi-normal mode, and it was done in a way where you just compose the boundary condition at the horizon, and you get exactly all the quasi-normal frequencies, and in fact, because of the ABS-DAQ correspondence,
okay,
you can match the answers that you get from this computation from what you would expect.
So this is the Birmingham Cardiff?
Well, no, this is Starinex and, you know, Starinex is a company computation some time ago. So in that case, that puts well-defined prescription to their quasi-normal mode, which looked like to be very physically reasonable. And so I just wonder what
one question. The monotony calculations of Motul and Nitschke, which we are using here, there they do use to calculate it in two ways that need to go around the sphere.
In this case,
is that right? I know very few things.
Especially. Yes, his talk is next.
Okay. Anyway, so this is the final result, if you like, or our main result. And you see that it does depend, in a nutshell, on the horizon and the singularity. The horizon term comes here in terms of C naught. And as I said, that for non-degenerative black holes, 1 over 4 pi C naught, the whole thing would be just the Hawking temperature. For degenerate, it's proportional to the inverse of horizon radius. So the horizon information is here, and the singularity information comes in here in terms of Q. But the singularity also has another integer, which is P, which does not enter the calculation. And just to repeat that, you know, it need not be an integer, but I don't know exactly why, but in all the computations that we did, it did turn out to be integers. Now, so we can apply this formula. First, we check that it works out. So the applications, first we do D plus two-dimensional short range, which is known, just to check that we get the right answer. Then we do D plus two-dimensional extremal horizon construct. Extremal because our assumption was that it's a single horizon black hole. So an extremal horizon construct is a single horizon, two horizons on each side. We can apply that. As far as I know, before our computation, the extremal horizon construct was not constant in calculation. And two-dimensional streamy black holes, one of the authors are here. And then four-dimensional streamy black holes, and then five-dimensional streamy black holes. I'll just remind the metric, the short side and rise constant. No, for two-dimensional streamy black holes, it's the metric here encompasses basically all the three black holes. So some have matter, some have don't, and we can do alternate transformation to go from one to the other. For four-dimensional streaming black holes, now F and G are of this form. This is a generalization of the Gartic field Horowitz from the charged black hole metric with a singular horizon. And here, this alpha is a free parameter. If you put alpha equal to 0, you get back usual rise constant. If you put alpha equal to 1, you get back the exact Gartic field Horowitz parameter. This is a generalization which interpolates between the two. And these are FG, this is the rho parameter, rho function, this is the mass of the black hole, the charge, and the Hawking temperature. Five-dimensional spinning black hole is more interesting because it carries Ramond around charges, and it's things like the horizons are singular and stuff like that. And there you actually have three charges, and FG are related this way. The three charges, well, the three numbers here, parameters alpha, gamma, and sigma, are related to the three charges for the five-dimensional black hole, which is the number of T1, B brains, number of one brains, number of five brains, and the momentum on the common intersection of the one brain and the five brain. So that's N. Now, the R equal to 0 for the stringy black hole, when all the parameters are non-zero, when all alpha, comma, sigma, all three are non-zero, R equal to 0 is a non-singular surface. So it's a non-singular point. The curvature does not go up there. Therefore, you know, that thing does not go through and it becomes irrelevant. Therefore, we have chosen one of the parameters to be 0. This makes R equal to 0 singular, and this makes the Hawking temperature to be 2 pi horizon radius cos alpha cos gamma to the power minus 1. There could have been a factor of cos sigma as well, but then that becomes 1 because of the assumption of sigma going to 0. So we do get a black hole with a horizon and a singularity. And so for these black holes, for the three stringy black holes that singularize to non-strong and short side in three-dimensional curvature zone, you can calculate the quasi-normal modes. I just tabulate it here. The first line is for any black hole with generic singularity, one horizon. Okay. The second one is for three-dimensional short side. We obviously get that as E log 3. For four-dimensional stringy, which is generalization of the particle for Schrödinger, we still get log 3. That's what seems interesting to me, that we do get a log integer again. For five-dimensional stringy, which is this essentially similar to the black holes that Schrödinger and Pfaffer use, and all stringy five-dimensional black holes. So there, they again turn out to be pH log 3. For two-dimensional stringy black holes, say the CGHS or something similar, it's interesting, you can put the values of D and D here and for the normal modes to be 0 actually. Well, it becomes log 1, so it is a log integer, but 0, fine with that. And the D plus 2 dimension Reissel-Nordström, the T is 0 of course, but even though the Hawking temperature is 0, we do still get a log 2, not a log 3, and the coefficient which turns out in front is not the Hawking temperature, it's 1 by some number times the horizon radius, which is this. And again, you see this in general is not necessarily an integer, but in all the cases that we have computed, and we have been trying to apply it for some, you know, whatever is known, so you know, whatever satisfies our criterion, you can just put the value of the dimension and Q and find. And we're trying to find out some other things as well, and it does turn out to be integers as far as it is. Yes. Well, the quasi-normal mode here does have information about the singularity.
So, what does that mean?
I'm happy for this.
I actually think that this. That
yeah, I mean, you know, for within dynamics, you are saying, what else, we will abandon certain populations now. Where these informations may be correlated, that's to say, if you are choosing a certain domain of the functions f, g, and rho,
right?
By saying that the index index q, and a certain domain of that is allowed, because that sort of a structure can be continued by the equation of motion through outside and so on, and it may have information. That's why the equation of motion. But suppose you have a completely arbitrary Lagrangian, then you can pick the same index structure near the same biology, and do anything you like from present onwards. So,
but they may not be. I mean, there could be issues of continuity, or you know that.
Yeah, but those are some very weak conditions. I mean, you can have Einstein gravity plus any kind of possible.
Also, conditions. What you're probably saying that you don't care whether they satisfy the equations of motion or not. Or you know, it may satisfy some very bizarre equation.
Which you don't care about, right? Yeah. Even talking about the classical solution, right, and so on. So if you specify the domain of the index,
right?
Okay, you know, that's. I mean, you can tinker with the metric in a sort of more arbitrary fashion. we have the singularity. And still satisfy the junction conditions and you know what are you at the horizon. And you know the rest of the physics beyond the horizon of solution of the radial equation.
Well, we are not here.
I'm saying the same thing, except that in a particular dynamics, you know, people may have calculated by you know, fixing parameters of the metric near the singularity because they have been sort of related to the metric outside by their dynamics. Mm-hmm. If things were dynamics, they would be there.
Well, I mean, the dynamics, in a way, when we are applying this to particular black holes, like extremely black holes or extremalized transformers, or which is already known earlier, we can perhaps try to put the BTs there and see. I mean, there is dynamics in that way, right? Because when we assume the form of the metric, the singularity near the horizon, I agree. I mean, we're not assuming that it's satisfied certain fixed points. But when we're applying it to certain black holes, I guess there is dynamics involved there.
No, I mean, the mapping advantage. That's what I mean.
I strongly suspect that, you know, there are, depends if you want to present it, there are two computations in a sense. One, when I use physical intuition,
right.
Nothing goes outside of the horizon, and this other one. And the only reason, so in a sense, it's an accident that it agrees in general. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in the specific example that it agrees, it's precisely the two things. There is an underlying Lagrangian. There is an underlying.
That would be,
I would really be very surprised, and honestly, at this stage, I don't believe this. I will talk to Andrew just to make sure that there is an alternative way to the computations. And you should not be able to see anything about the singularity by studying quasi normal models. That should not, that's just physically inconsistent.
Well,
so anything, you know, that parameter Q
right.
is probably somehow.
You're saying it's remnant of the horizon.
It's remnant, you know, it's remnant of the horizon plus the fact that the physics in the. Mathematical, it's the same equations in this graph.
In fact,
I can, you know, strictly speaking, I can go inside the graph and I just have to choose the coordinate system of the coordinate zero. So there is no, you know.
Yes.
Well, yeah, there are two things. I mean, what you said, that could be true. And secondly, that could be the reason why we are getting, you know, nice numbers in all the cases where we are applying. Because we are not applying for without black holes. We are applying for black holes, which has a nice underlying equation of motion and stuff like that. On the other hand, the motivation of our computation was not to probe singularity. The motivation of our computation was to compute quasi-normal modes for as general black holes as possible. So this does, with this formulation, we can compute the, you know, the 1, 2, 3, 4, which.
So this is a trivial check. Just, you know, you have a perturbation that is described by the set of this quasi-normal dream. You just compute the flux near the horizon and see whether the flux of that perturbation vanishes at the horizon. Or, I mean, whether there is an outgoing wave at the horizon. That should be a trivial computation.
But that's our boundary. You could impose the boundary condition, right? It is.
And there is a parameter Q that enters in that boundary condition.
At the origin, at the singularity, we just assume that it is a regular singularity.
No, I don't talk about the singularity. You don't go to the singularity. You impose the boundary condition as a parameter.
It is an ingoing. That's right.
Yes, it's ingoing boundary condition. Can you check this?
Yeah.
Okay. So what's the other boundary condition?
Other boundary condition that it's at infinity. It's of the. It's outgoing as well.
Okay, so that's all the boundary predictions.
Yeah.
That predicts you the frequency. You don't need to know anything about the singularity. Why the issue of the singularity shows up? You have a second order differential equation.
Yeah.
You have two integration constants.
Right.
One is an arbitrary, it's just an amplitude of the perturbation.
Right.
So two integration constants. Mm-hmm. It's not an integral. One integration constant plus one constraint on the frequencies.
Right.
That's what you impose.
Right. But if you have a second order differential equation, if you want to have regular solutions of it, it should have, for this particular case, at r equal to 0, at the horizon, they should be regular solutions, right? And should be irregular at high. These are required conditions. And we, so with the metric that, with modulo, you know, the caveats that we have been discussing, with the metric near the singularity that we are assuming, the P and Q does satisfy some constraint if you want the singularity to be regular at the origin.
No, but then what I guess what I'm trying to say is second order differential equation is parameterized by two unknown constants.
Yes.
One constant goes away because we can scale amplitude away. So you have one iteration constant. Now you have two boundary conditions. One is the horizon, the other one is integration. That's two boundary.
I agree.
One of them fixes you the unknown integration, and the other one will fix you the spectrum.
Okay.
Of the
there's
nothing inside the horizon.
There's no denying that. But again, there are two points. One is that near the origin, you do require the singularity to be a regular singularity.
No, that's an extra constraint.
It's not clear why you have to do that.
Yeah,
but I thought you used the information from the singularity to somehow throw away one of the terms in V.
That's right.
It's obvious to me why you needed to know about the singularity to do that.
Well,
that I'm missing that. Why is that? Why can't you just throw it away?
Just counting arguments, you should not be any extra constraint might just simply be inconsistent.
No, it is not.
Well, then this is what we suggested that it might be inconsistent in the sense by accident. Precisely because we look at this, you know, at the
because they're solutions of the same right.
But physically physically you should not be able to do that. Because that's a constraint which you no longer have
sure.
a parameter.
Sure. Yes, that could definitely be a possibility. I don't deny that.
It's
probably okay, maybe. Check that. But on the other hand, my calculations or the motivation of my calculation was not to prove the singularity. The motivation of my calculation was to compute quasi-normal modes for as general backup as possible. So we have been able to use this formula to calculate the quasi-normal modes for a few other black holes which people have not done earlier. So well, okay, the issue of whether to go into this, you know, the singularity does throw up in the quasi, it's a good question.
So I just want to trust the computations that you did, and for that you need to be able to do this. I want to make sure that you can get away without this. If you tell me you can, then that's a very
I'm not telling you can. I'm just saying that we are using the monotomy approach of functional language scale, where they do use this calculated monotomy in two ways where the singularity comes from.
Okay.
I'm not just saying that, as I said, even Morton had a previous paper where I don't know whether they use that structure or not. But this is one way of calculating. And it's true that it could be that we are the underlying theory being the same near the horizon, near the singularity, that's an implicit presumption which goes in. That's possible. And that could be the reason why we do get nice answers and we don't get any log. Modeling and things like that. Anyway, these are the answers that we get. And just one last thing, that we return to the implications of two quantum gravity. So in general, for the quasi-normal modes frequencies of the real part that we got, the areas would be deeply spaced anyway, but this would be the coefficient, not log 3 in general. And if we equate this to the minimum area spectrum in terms of the so-called emissive parameter in gravity, this would be a prediction for the emissive parameter just by equating these top two lines. And with the number of punctures being area of the black hole divided by delta A, the entropy of the black hole would be the Bekenstein-Hawking part, which is area divided by 4, times log of 1 plus 2jm, the minimum spin that one considers in any quantum gravity, and divide by log of this factor which comes to the first of the nodes. And this would be 1, this factor would be 1, if you choose the jn, the minimum spin, to be cos pi 2 minus 1. And again, for Schwarzschild, the thing inside turns out to be 0, at least, so it's cos 0, which is 1, and that's what, in Olaf's calculation, for example, was what he chose. So this could be a more general thing, and I would like to check for other examples. I end with a summary and discussion. So we found the quasi-normal modes for generic singularity black holes, or for more general black holes, it's always a log integer for all the examples that you consider. Again, I don't have a deeper understanding of it, but it seems interesting to me that a bunch of predictions, and especially if you make Einstein's conjecture really well invariant, that the number of black hole states, which is entropy exponentially as an integer, all these things, and that you know you can equate the polynomial mode frequency with the periodic frequency of the black hole, all these things seem to go through its log integer. The crucial fact that has been used here, in fact, this I think is more important in a way, that what turned out for all the cases which they are non-degenerate is the polynomial modes turned out in proportion to the Hawking temperature, and that is crucial to all this adiabatic invariant and all the other arguments. Now, this is again, it's true what we found for these black holes, but I don't know whether it's in general true, so we would like to generalize it for multiple horizons, rotating black holes and black holes which are non-asymptotically flat. And in those cases, one would have to, be very interesting to see, whether the polynomial mode frequencies turn out proportional to the Hawking temperature. I think that's the crucial point, that in all the cases, it's proportional to Hawking temperature that we have computed. And if this does not go through, I mean, when it's zero, it's okay, it's not contradictory to it. But if it's not proportional to the Hawking temperature, for example, for Eisenstrom, it could have been proportional to 1 over r plus or 1 over r minus, but it comes out to be proportional to exactly r plus minus r minus divided by the area, which is the Hawking temperature, essentially. And that's what seems to be surprising to me, and we'd like to go more. So, anyway, thank you for your attention, and Dr. Shaw, here.
Thank you.
Yes.
I just want to make another comment. So yeah. I don't understand the significance of long integer for the following reasons.
Yeah.
So first of all, in string theory, there are black holes where you know I can have a smooth horizon, so parameters are very small. However, in a string theory, as you probably know, there are also alpha prime corrections. There are higher probability terms. And in those cases, the amplitude of the black hole is not given by just the area of the horizon divided by 4. It's actually a little bit more complicated expression for that. It's been derived by Wolf, and it agrees with you know lots of other independent ways of doing the computation. So I'm not, you know, I guess from the perspective of loop quantum gravity, you want this. Is what you were saying is you want that to be an integer because you know that was related to
No. Here at this point integer is not important. What's important is that it's proportional to T.
Yes, that I find not surprising because that's if you wish a diffeomorphism invariant scale of your solution. That's a temperature. R plus, as you were saying, is not an invariant quantity by itself. The temperature is well defined.
Well, it could have been square root of area, right? That's in very common.
It's not really my this my comment is not related.
But I have a question. Is the stringy black hole that you say is area by 4 still the leading term?
Yes, it is because alpha prime, because in those computations what is happening is
small correction. Yeah, because the reason I asked is that you can consider, you know, forget a particular theory of quantum gravity. You can consider black hole as a thermodynamic system, consider statistical fluctuations together anyway, right? And it's well known by now that, you know, the leading order corrections after that is log area with some coefficient. So those things are there as well.
It's not there. But what I am saying is really important because if you use the naive formula, which is just the area of the horizon divided by 4, it turns out in those black holes, you can independently compute the free energy and energy and the entropy. And so you can actually verify the first law of thermodynamics. Mm-hmm. So what is happening is that unless we use the correct expression for the entropy, in the presence of higher derivative corrections, you will not satisfy the first law of thermodynamics.
That's why I asked. It's still the leading term. So it's still true.
It's not more. It's not corrected by, as you were saying.
I'm just saying that. So. Forgetting about higher order corrections, even like mere thermodynamic fluctuations, there are corrections to area of 4.
Yes.
So when if you're just talking about corrections, you know, I mean, corrections to arise.
Because I can only sensibly talk about corrections if they are small. Because, you know, if I include just leading alpha prime corrections, and if I claim that they are large, you can ask me why I don't include further corrections.
Sure.
Okay, Rob. But, well, just related to that, I mean, if the black hole has not charged, entropy is not proportional to area, then that's not a small fraction.
Okay, so these are different deposits.
So, well, but, I mean, maybe that would be an interesting
thing to see. Absolutely. In fact, no, I just, when I said different topology, I just meant that the boundary conditions, sorry, the singularity structure and everything that we assume might have to be modified. One might have to modify that to three boundary. Yeah, that's interesting.
Okay, any more questions? If not, let's.
Hi.
Okay, so what's happening is AP3 is going to be a very humanistic sense of space, very humanistic. First of all, look, I mean,